This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson. Today, as we are going to do every Friday, our producer Carrie Jr. and I are going to take a look back at some of the highlights of our show from the week. Carrie, we had a really interesting variety of guests and topics this week.
We did. I like that this culmination of episodes and topics really show kind of what we're going to be doing for the show going forward.
Yeah. Well, we covered U.S. history being retold, constitutional law and voters' rights, and a cash infusion for mothers and children. And I think all of those really get at the breadth, the variety, the real spectrum of things that we want to talk about under the umbrella of inequality and opportunity in our country.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we were first conceiving this episode, a lot of these guests, too, were one of your first ideas. They are really the people that you're saying, if these are the people on the top of my list who I'm thinking of that are a lot of different definitions of what inequality and inequity represent. There's Ned Blackhawk, a Native American scholar whose work is new despite being historical in nature. And that's because he's trying to unmake and correct the incorrect histories that have been written often into the narrative of our nation.
Yeah, and our discussion with Ned was really eye-opening for me, especially because I went to school with Ned and have known him for a really long time. It's amazing to see him doing this work now as a professor at Yale.
Awesome. Yeah, and you know, as you touched on for that episode, neither one of us felt like we got adequate enough education in history. So that was a good topic to talk about.
Yeah.
We also spoke with Richard Primus, a law professor of is taking Donald Trump off the presidential ballot infringing on voters' rights? And could that set a dangerous precedent?
Yeah, my worry is, of course, not about Donald Trump or the people who would vote for him necessarily. It's about what this would inspire in the future in terms of the kinds of disqualifications we could see from states that would affect other kinds of voters, voters who in history have seen themselves disenfranchised. So we wanted Richard Primus, who's a really great constitutional scholar, to walk us through that and talk about why what's happening makes sense in a constitutional sense.
Absolutely. That was a really interesting one to get into for me as well, because I really wanted to better understand what the intricacies of that constitutional language means. And I think that you and Primate had a really interesting conversation.
Well, Richard was the one who's the expert, right?
right.
I'm not the expert. I'm just a journalist.
But you had the knowledge to conceive of the concept of that episode, right? Like, you knew the whole.
I knew that's who we needed to talk to. That was for sure.
That's what we do.
I understand. And then lastly, we talk with someone who I think has embodied action and justice in our state. Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha is a pediatrician who was among the first people to start waving red flags over what was happening in Flint with the water crisis. And since then, of course, she has been trying to help make up for all the damage that was done in Flint. And she has come up with this incredible new idea to move cash assistance to every pregnant mother in Flint and to support them in the first year of their child's birth with $500 a month. It's a really groundbreaking idea. Right. Luke Schaefer, who is the executive director of U of M's Poverty Solutions, is her partner in this, and they're about to get started. They expect that this could end poverty in Flint, and so we talk about why they believe that and how that would work.
I don't think I've ever heard of a program that tries to just give cash to people on such a broad scale. So that alone was fascinating for me. Yeah. So I'm interested to let people see the highlights of what we talked about.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get started with Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha and Luke Schaefer talking about RX kits. But this new program is aimed at moving cash assistance to every mother who is having a child in the city of Flint as a way of offsetting the effects of poverty in that city. Of course, the water crisis exacerbated all kinds of other problems that Flint has had for a really long time. RX Kids is focused on interrupting that cycle, interrupting it at the point where it could make the most difference, when children are actually born. With us is Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, who was the physician in Flint who really first identified the problems that the city was having with the water crisis, the lead poisoning that was taking place citywide. Also with us is Dr. Luke Schaefer. He is the head of an organization called Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. They are partners in RX Kids. So we were talking about how this works and how the money will move to these families and what you expect it to do. I want to talk about a really specific part of this program, though, which is the idea that it's universal, right? You are not means testing this. You are not looking at different parts of the city and saying, well, this is a place where we really need this and we don't need it over here. Everybody in Flint is eligible. Every mother is eligible for this. And, you know, we're having an argument about that approach right now in the state with regard to something the governor is trying to do. She says that the free breakfast program that we have in schools, which is means tested generally, should only be, she says it should be available to everyone as well. And there are people who are cheering that, but there are other people who are saying, that's a waste. You are giving this away to people who don't need it. And we could use those resources in a different way for those who do need it. I want to have you guys talk about the concept behind universality and why it's what you chose for this program.
Yeah, I think there's a couple reasons why we wanted this to be universal. And I think for me, the most important reason is that this is fundamentally how we should be caring for each other. Everyone is struggling during this period of childbirth and infancy. And this is a—
regardless of whether you're rich or poor.
Everybody is struggling. It is hard. You talk to folks in the middle class. You talk to folks, you know, like, yeah, it's hard. You know, I needed to do this and this, and childcare was like another mortgage, you know, paying for childcare. So everybody is struggling. And this is a strong message of saying, here we are, recognizing you, seeing and hearing how hard it is, and we are walking alongside you. And this is what other countries do. This is a universal benefit in so many other countries. So that's kind of the message that we want to send with the universality of it. But when you do put any means testing to anything, it makes it a more complicated program. It makes it a more expensive program.
Why?
Because you have to determine who's in and who's out. And then when you determine who's in and who's out, there's a line that is put in the sand, and then there's animosity. Why did that person get in, and why did I not get in? Because I'm struggling too. So it's administratively more complicated to have any means testing. And it goes against this message once again that this is how we should be caring for children. And I'm sure Luke has some other important things to share.
Yeah, when you look at the history of our safety net, we have historically taken the approach of saying, you know, who's above the line, who's below the line. And those programs create exactly the kind of animosity that Mona's mentioning, where somebody, you know, maybe not somebody way, way at the top, but somebody who's, you know, struggling to make ends meet, well above poverty, but still trying to figure out how to pay for childcare, diapers, says, hey, you know, I'm playing by the rules. Why am I not getting this? And it creates divisions between people. And then the other piece is that it has the impact of stigmatizing people below the line. So if you're asking a lot of different questions, and if you're really focused on making sure people who get the aid really deserve it, then those questions can actually pile up very quickly. And Michigan had this, you know, interesting example where we had like the longest public benefits application in the country. There were all these incredibly intrusive questions that got added. It was super complicated. There was a question about, saying the date of the conception of your child, right? What, like, these things are incredibly personal, and they send all of these messages. So there's a really interesting study done by some colleagues of mine on nurse home visits. So we think nurse home visits can be really helpful to families. But they have very low take up a lot of the time. People
won't sign up
interested,
for it.
Yeah, or don't sign up. And there was a community that actually made that program universal. So it had been something that had only been offered to low-income families, and they said, we're going to make it universal and offer it to everyone, and then we'll figure out how to pay for it. Some of it's going to be government funds. Some of it's going to be philanthropic funds. And the biggest impact was that families who had already been eligible before took it up more. They were more willing to do it. In part, maybe it seemed less complicated. And then the second piece was maybe it seemed like we were sending a very different message. Yeah. So that all feeds into what Mona's talking about of, like, it's a very different thing to say, we're giving you this money because you can't handle this, your business, you're poor, versus we're giving you this money because you're doing one of the most important things, if not the most important thing for society, which is raising your kids.
Investment in our
big
nation.
Philosophical difference, though, right, that you're talking about there.
Absolutely. And it plays into the argument about school lunches and what does it mean to have, like, separate lines? What does it mean to interrogate families about whether or not they're eligible? In Flint and in lower-income cities, we have the benefit of, you know, everybody is – we have this extremely high poverty rate. But there is a very strong argument to be made that actually saying by serving everyone, I do better by – the kids who need it the most.
It helps everybody. UNICEF has a recent report that also advocates for universal global child benefits. And the international evidence also shows that you have to at least include the middle class so that, you know, there would be enough support for these kind of programs.
Yeah. And in a way, this is also about trusting mothers and families to determine what's best for them and what they need, as opposed to having government decide what people need. And I guess I'm always surprised that that doesn't play more with conservatives. That's what they are supposedly believe, is that we should be making these decisions for ourselves. Now, I know this is, a subsidy of sorts, and that brings in other dynamics. But there is something to this idea that the people who are having these children know best about what they're doing.
Yeah, it is about freedom and choice for moms. And I think that's why libertarians are very supportive of unconditional cash transfers. I'm going to read you a quote from the 1920s when the child benefits were first introduced in the UK. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of debate about, like, should we tell folks what to spend their money on, or should we just give them the money and they know best? And there was an amazing woman named Eleanor Rathbone who kind of led the movement for family allowances and then child benefits in the UK. And she said, "We are convinced that the money so dispersed would be spent both wisely and economically, since it is our view the mothers themselves are best able, because of their experience and training and their overwhelming personal interest, to apportion this expenditure in the way most calculated to secure the well-being of their children. No public authority can, in our view, make money go as far in the provision of food, clothing, and healthy surroundings as can the mothers who have learned economy in the hard school of experience."
Wow. Wow. That's from the 20s.
19th century. More than a century ago. More than a century ago.
No new thing under the sun.
Yeah.
I'll just say, too, with the expanded child tax credit, we had tons of studies that asked, you know, using tons of different data, what did families spend the money on? And there was no impact on alcohol or tobacco spending. Families spent it on food. They spent it on rent. They spent it on books and toys for kids. Really, by providing that trust, too, I think families really take it seriously, and we can see that in the data.
But that's kind of counterintuitive to some of the narrative around poverty and how poor people make decisions, right? There's a lot in our culture that says these are people who got the way they are through negligence or on purpose, and couldn't get themselves out if they were even given the resources. I mean, you're really doubling down on pushing back against that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is an interesting question. I have a new book out called The Injustice of Place, and a lot of it delves into the history of very, very poor places in the United States. And just like Mona read a quote from the 1920s, I could read you quotes and have them in my book from the 1800s about how the poor are just living off, you know, government support, and they don't work hard enough, and they don't use their resources wisely. Back when we had, like, no safety net, you know, there was, like, nothing around. And so these ideas are very deep and entrenched, and there might be an example when you provide cash, an example of somebody not using it wisely. But in the aggregate, time and time again, we see this is a way to, like, meet families' needs exactly where they are. Mm-hmm. Families spend it wisely. My favorite factoid about the child tax credit, besides reducing food hardship to the lowest level ever, reducing child poverty, increasing financial security, according to the Federal Reserve, was the number of Americans with bad credit actually hit an all-time historic low at the end of 2021 after we provided families' money, because they used it to, like, shore up their debt.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen, we're very deliberate in working to change that narrative, because that narrative is a myth. And a lot of this work that we are doing is working to rebuild trust and dignity and agency and empowerment, and really celebrate our moms and our families who are working so hard to raise their children. They love their kids just as much as you and I love their kids.
And you're not saying that just as a believer in that philosophy. I mean, you're saying that as somebody who is treating the children who come from these families and
absolutely
in these circumstances every day. And
absolutely.
So do you see that?
Yeah,
I see
the moms working two jobs with a newborn, but still trying to make their appointments and do everything that they can to raise their children, but do not have the resources to be able to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the other thing I feel like the universality gets at is the fluidity of poverty and economic circumstances, which I think is increasing, right? And maybe it's the pandemic. There are some other things that have changed in the economy over the last decade or so. But the number of people who find themselves in really awful economic circumstances suddenly, even after years of living stably, is going up. And so if you try to means test something like this, you'd have to do it like every week, because the pool of people
exactly
who qualify
right
is changing all the time.
Yeah, there's a great book out by some economists at NYU and that finds that the financial lives of poor families, we think of these as like static categories. You're in poverty, you're in the working poor, and as you say, actually, the norm is huge swings from well above poverty, and it's really a matter of when you find families and where they are. And so that creates a lot of challenges, because so much of our safety net is means tested. And so families will just be getting a foothold. They'll be working, and then suddenly their food benefits will be cut off, and they can go into, you know, a crisis that way. Medicaid insurance, you know, health insurance, and families are really worried about those. So that's another part of the way ARCS Kids is designed, is to say $1,500 in pregnancy, $500 a month until your baby turns one. This is one thing in all of this instability that you can count on from month to month that can provide that stability. You go to work, you don't go to work. This is what you can really build other things around. And that stability just is so much different from how the labor market works, how most of our public benefits work. And,
yeah,
and we hope will help stabilize families.
Yeah. That was Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha and Dr. Luke Schaefer, who are working together on the new program for Flint moms and babies. It's called RX Kids. Coming up, scholar and historian Ned Blackhawk will talk to us about the unmaking of U.S. history.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Created Equal. Ned Blackhawk is a native Detroiter and an historian at Yale University. We talk with him about his book, Rediscovering America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Ned, as I said earlier in the show, you're a native Detroiter, in addition to being a member of a Native nation here in the United States. And you and I share a common high school, a common education of sorts. And I started the interview by talking about the gaps in that education, the things that we weren't exposed to at University of Detroit Jesuit High School here in Detroit, the things about Native peoples that just weren't part of the curriculum. For me, that led to what I have to admit to is an ignorance about that history. But I've thought since discovering your book and learning more about your career that must have looked and felt really different for you, someone who has a connection, a biological connection to Native peoples here in the United States. And so I do wonder what effect that had on you and how that plays into the decisions you make later in life to become a scholar of history and to write a book like The Rediscovery of America, which really, again, calls for a rethink of our history in a way that accounts more for the Native story.
I think we both grew up on the west side of Detroit. I grew up over near 6 Mile and the Southfield Freeway. Our first home was over right off Greenfield and Fenkel.
Mm-hmm.
5 Mile for those who understand. So I spent my entire first 18 years of my life on Detroit's west side. I went to Cook Elementary and then regional public school before going to U of D, where we met. And so I'm very familiar with the kind of misunderstandings that people have about Native Americans, especially people in Detroit. Not mm-hmm. that Detroit is unique in that regard. But in some strange way, I have spent I spent a portion of my career teaching in at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where there are 11 federally recognized tribes that are far more visible than the tribes in Michigan are. Mm. And so in certain parts of the Midwest, in Wisconsin and Minnesota, I also lived in Canada where I went to college. Indigenous peoples are more visible in the kind of everyday political and social and now economic life of these regions. But that wasn't the case in Detroit so much, particularly in the 80s, when a series of national policies kind of started eroding attempts from the 70s to try to restore and support various Native political and economic initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
I write about that actually in the end of the book. And so it's kind of an interesting subject matter. Because now, with gaming and other kind of exertions of tribal sovereignty, tribal nations are much more visible in the upper Midwest than they were when we were growing up. So it could be that I'm a single child, that I didn't have real peers to kind of who were going through a similar experience. I also have an Indian last name. My mom, as you know, is a non-Indian, former Detroit school teacher. Mm-hmm. My dad is from Nevada, where our tribe and family are from. I am an enrolled member there, though I never lived there until I was an adult. So I have this kind of very unique biography and background, but it's actually very common for American Indians of my generation, in part because these were the policies of the federal government throughout the post-war era of the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s and 70s, to forcibly either terminate tribal communities and or relocate their community members to urban environments. Detroit was not a big relocation center compared to a place like Chicago or mm-hmm. Cleveland, but there are still thousands of urban Indians across the Detroit area, some of whom I grew up in and around, given my dad's interest in these subjects. So my experience as an urban Indian is not that unusual, but it did breed a lot of uncertainty and a sense of kind of difference that took me a while to manage. And so you can probably imagine the types of things young children say to each other on the playgrounds of Detroit or in the schoolyards or in the classroom and so forth. It wasn't perhaps the kindest world, but in a certain sense, I really value the experience in life I've had, I had in Detroit growing up, because there was at the time and still today a real deep commitment to integration in, you know, in certain forms. And so it wasn't as if in our neighborhood we were the only non-white family. You know, there were plenty of people of color over in our neighborhood. And, you know, there are, you know, people from all over the world, really. A lot of people, Lebanese grocers and Chaldean party store owners and, you know, Korean cleaners and people who ran businesses from all kinds of backgrounds and walks of life. And so there was a kind of heterogeneity and diversity that wasn't perhaps as pernicious as one might find elsewhere.
And at what point does it come to you that, hey, not only do I have this inherent human and biological connection to this, but I have an intellectual curiosity about it and the desire to kind of correct what's going wrong with the storytelling here, that that so much of our nation doesn't ever get exposed to the story of Native peoples and their interrelations with Europeans who come here. At what point for you does that become it has become the central part of your work. Where does that motivation come from?
Well, I think two things kind of happened to me around the same time. When I was in college in Canada in the late 80s and early 90s, I found myself unaware of the pre-existing kind of political activities that were percolating across the region. Hmm. So it's somewhat of a long story, but I did end up choosing to go to school in Quebec rather than Ann Arbor.
Oh.
And so rather than meeting classmates or perhaps a dorm member, you know, rather than living in Ann Arbor in the late 80s, I moved to Canada where I knew no one and found myself living literally within a French Canadian town, attending an Anglophone school at a time when Mohawk Indians outside of the city were taking over bridges and contesting the kind of encroachment of municipalities onto their reserve lands. This is known as the Oka Crisis of 1990. Mm-hmm. And it brought to my attention the political reality of Native peoples there in a way that I'd never seen in my life before. I knew about like my own tribe struggles with the federal government and various things of that nature. But I'd never seen, defiant and militant and kind of empowered indigenous activism of any kind of this form. I'd seen, you know, movies or read books or something. But so it really imprinted itself upon me. And I'll be honest and kind of share that it's put me on a path of self-reflection where I started realizing that this part of my life, which I, you know, always knew about, I wish I had more knowledge of. And so I decided that I would, reach out to my dad's siblings. And I moved from Canada out west and, became essentially someone whose life was both intellectually and personally committed to this subject.
Wow. I mean, that's such a familiar tale. I think many African Americans find that same moment in life where you start to ask questions about, hey, where am I from? Where are my people from? And how did we get here? And what is the history that, you know, again, we weren't necessarily taught in school about all of that. And so you see lots of people going, for instance, from Detroit back to southern states, right? My own family, I've gone back to Natchez, Mississippi, which is where my dad is from, to learn much more about where we come from and what the history was that brought us to this place. For Native peoples, I think one of the differences is that that the history there is perhaps more, even more obscure and more buried, right? The things that you're writing about in your book, The Rediscovery of America, are many of them are ideas of first impression for me. I mean, things I just never have heard of. And I can't think of, even in the African American context, the same kind of things that would just never have even been thought of. Was there in this journey a difficulty in exploring all of these things to the extent that you did? And also, was there resistance that you met, I guess, along the way in the academy, right? Thinking about higher ed in particular and how unrepresented Native peoples and Native peoples' ideas are there. I wonder what that journey might have looked like for you.
The short answer is yes and yes. It was a process of personal challenge and academic resistance, in part because there were so few peers and role models or mentors. And so I did bounce between graduate programs, in part because of these resistances. I essentially found myself in a secure place academically, but it was not in the elite pantheon of academic institutional settings. To get the kind of education I really needed in the mentorship required me to go to a Pac-12 school in the state of Washington at the University of Washington, which is a great university and had a great mentor, but it was just far afield from the centers of academic authority at, sure, say, Berkeley, Ann Arbor, Chicago, or Ivy League places. So I never anticipated ending up in these places because of those early years of being lost in a new universe. But over time, I and many others became part of this generation that has rediscovered American history. And there's a kind of growing movement to reform these often inadequate paradigms.
Yeah, yeah. And so now you're at Yale University, of course, an Ivy League university by any measure, prestigious. You're a history professor there. I wonder, are you the only Native American who is in the history department at Yale? I mean, is it that isolating, or have we made more progress in that?
I am the only one in the history department at the time. There have been a few other faculty during my time here, and we now have three Native American and/or Indigenous faculty teaching on campus. I don't feel that isolated because three is a lot more than one. And many of these Ivy League schools are a lot smaller than Big Ten schools like Michigan or Ohio State. So, sure. We're not large in numbers, but we have we're large in spirit, perhaps.
Yeah. And do you still find resistance to the work? This book has met with all kinds of critical acclaim outside of the academy, and of course, you won the National Book Award for it. But inside places like Yale, is there still the need on your part, do you feel, for the kind of vigilance to make the case, to make the argument that this is an important story, We've got to keep telling it. We've got to keep exploring it.
You know, I was the first tenured Native American faculty member appointed here in 2008-09. That gave me a lot of standing that I have kind of tried to inhabit. So I don't feel the resistance so much on campus as I do across the profession, because many of my peers, institutional settings like Stanford or until recently Harvard, didn't have faculty at all. So without faculty, this field doesn't really exist, and it doesn't provide students the kind of mentorship or support, let alone reach into publishing or kind of textbook type of worlds. So I'm actually very, kind of satisfied or kind of extremely humbled by the recognition that this book is getting. There have been a few kind of concerned reviews from the early American historians who think some of what I'm doing isn't that new, but it's not a book of research findings in the same way, as it's more of a synthetic interpretive overview that is doing the type of things that I think you're recognizing.
That was historian Ned Blackhawk, author of Rediscovering America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Coming up, is removing Donald Trump from the ballot in states like Colorado infringing on voters' basic rights to choose their candidates? And if so, does that set a dangerous precedent? I'm going to talk with law professor Richard Primus about it all right after this. Back to Created Equal on 101.9 WDET. Last week, the Supreme Court heard arguments about Donald Trump's removal from the ballot in states like Colorado based on a section of the 14th Amendment that is known as the Insurrection Clause. University of Michigan law professor Richard Primus joined us to discuss the implications of the pending ruling. We try to answer the question, if Trump is removed from the ballot, is that infringing on voters' rights to have the candidates they want to choose from? And would that precedent be bad for our democracy? I want to get you to say what you think. Are the reasons that you believe Donald Trump meets the standards for disqualification under the 14th Amendment, third section? What tells you that he participated in an insurrection, and what tells you that that these states that have decided that they don't want him on the ballot because of that are the ones that to determine that? And that's of course what's before the Supreme Court now, but I want to get your take on that.
Okay. So the first thing that I want to say is I don't expect the Supreme Court to disqualify him. Right? It's always been I think they should take it very seriously. I think there's a very good case. Mm-hmm. It's always been a long shot, because courts in our system are very reluctant to get involved in elections on the front end. And so every cautious bone in the justices' bodies, right, tells them not to do this if they possibly can avoid it. And right. I think that instinct is going to win out. But on the merits, I think there's a pretty good case here. Insurrection, both as an original matter under the 14th Amendment and as applied in later cases, doesn't have to mean the Civil War. It doesn't have to be something that big, right? The framers of the 14th Amendment could have written, you know, people who were involved in the late Civil War disqualified. They didn't. They wrote a much more general instruction about insurrection. And insurrection has been understood in the past to mean organized oppositions to the lawful execution of the authority of the government.
Right.
And especially if that is an opposition to the government's core activities for deciding who will be in power, who the government will be, seems like a pretty good claim for insurrection. And that's what January 6th was. Hmm. It was an organized, violent attempt to resist the orderly transfer of authority in the government.
Right. But Donald Trump didn't show up for that insurrection.
No, he didn't. Right. Here's a question that I think that a lot of people should ask themselves when they think about this case. Imagine the facts of the case were a little different. Imagine that Donald Trump had been in the front of the crowd breaking into the Capitol and had been shouting through a megaphone, "We are here to prevent the certification of Joe Biden as president and to certify me instead."
Mm-hmm.
Would he then come under the bar of Section 3? There are some people who think, no, he still wouldn't, right? But if you think if he had done that, he would be barred by Section 3. Then the question is, and it's a good question, what's the difference between standing back, right, facilitating it, encouraging it, applauding it, not intervening to stop it when you've got the power to do it and people are begging you to do it,
mm-hmm.
and saying all kinds of nice things about it afterwards? What's the difference between all that and actively participating? I think that's a hard question.
Yeah.
I think that's a hard question. And then the question is, who decides?
Right, right. Do these states have a right to decide on their own and maybe create a situation where a candidate is on the ballot in a certain number of states, but not others?
Right. And now here's the funny thing about that. We think about that, and this, I think, is where a lot of the Supreme Court's most well-placed concern is. We think about that as a very explosive and unusual possibility, right? We don't want states deciding to keep major party candidates off the ballot for political reasons. That doesn't seem right, right? It is the case that presidential elections in this country operate as 51 different elections rather than as one nationwide election. There are no nationwide rules for who's on the ballot and how you qualify. It's done state to state. And there are lots of candidates who are on the ballots in some states and not in others, right? Usually not the major party candidates.
Right. There's people
but it happens
who,
with minor party candidates, right?
If you don't meet the qualifications, you don't get enough signatures, if you don't have the right kinds of – well, I mean, states get to set the threshold at which you get onto the ballot.
Correct. It would be a big problem if a state said, look – our Secretary of State or our legislature, we're from Party A, so we're not going to put on anyone from Party B.
Right.
Right. That's the thing we're trying to avoid, right? But we think it's totally normal for states to enforce bona fide ballot qualifications when they decide who to put on the ballot. Colorado and Maine, strictly speaking, are not disqualifying Donald Trump from the presidency because of Section 3. They don't have the power to do that, right? I mean, if all the other states vote him in, he's in.
He would still be in, right? They're just saying that in those states, he doesn't meet the qualifications for the ballot.
Well, they're saying that the decision, they're saying the Constitution says if you took an oath to the Constitution, and then you engage in insurrection, you cannot serve again. And they're saying, someone's got to enforce that. We here in our state have the legal responsibility and the legal power to decide who's on the ballot. It looks to us like it would be unconstitutional for this person to serve. So under our state election law, that means that we're not supposed to put him on the ballot. Yeah. Now, note, the federal government could clean this all up, right? If what we're concerned about is a nationwide process, Constitution...
Yeah, Congress could establish that, correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Constitution could remove the disability, or Congress could make a statute that says, here's what the nationwide process is going to be for determining who's disqualified. Yeah. In the absence of Congress's having done that, the normal way the 14th Amendment works is states have to enforce if a case is in front of them.
Right.
Now, I don't think the Supreme Court is going to decide in the way that I've just described. I think the facts of this case, right, the potential political explosiveness of the case, is likely to triumph over the normal way of doing 14th Amendment law. And they'll say, no, it's just too problematic for states to be doing this on their own. But if they do that, they'll be doing something that's a departure from the way that this normally works and from the way that I think they would do it if the stakes weren't so high.
Yeah, yeah. That was University of Michigan law professor Richard Primus. Okay, so Carrie, this was a really interesting week on Created Equal, our second week of shows. And what I loved about it was that it started to stretch the bounds of what we think of as subjects that fit under the umbrella of inequality and opportunity. Yeah, we're going to talk a lot about race. We're going to talk about gender. We're going to talk about all the things that people think of when they hear those words. But we're also going to try to introduce you to other subjects that really call on those themes. And this week, we did a lot of that.
Yeah, when I think of the conversation with Dr. Blackhawk, I think about how this is a history that was untold, that hasn't been told in the way that he's telling it, right? There is an unequal understanding of what and who the actors are in America's history. When I think of the conversation with Dr. Mona and Luke Schaefer, I think about how they're approaching inequality and equity differently or in a new way, right? With a program that should... or that they plant, that they hope will help, you know.
And opportunity.
Right, and opportunity. I mean, the opportunity
is going to
create.
Absolutely about exactly. Make sure that there's opportunity for people early. It's such an important part of the theme of the show, that kind of aspirational aspect of it. So,
and then with Primus, too, you know, the rights of voters being able to pick the candidates that they want to pick, and then whether or not that's going to be up to the courts and how they decide on that insurrection
and
trial,
what it means for the rest of us, right? If they do remove
Donald Trump, what that means,
yeah.
So I agree. I mean, they're definitely different approaches. When I think of inequality and equity, yeah, I think my first instinct is to go to not necessarily race, but like, oh, how are what's the problem here, right? But we've talked about the solutions in I think two episodes, right? With Blackhawk saying, hey, I'm going to help close this gap and reinterpret kind of our understanding of our history. And then with you know, like I said, Dr. Mona. So I like it. I'm excited about more episodes we're going to have going forward.
And of course, we have even more coming.
Absolutely.
Even more broadening of the idea of these themes on Created Equal.
Did you have a favorite not quote or moment from any of the episodes this past week?
Yeah, you can't ask people to pick among their children like, what their favorites are. I like all the episodes. I like all the guests.
That's the PC answer. I have one for myself.
You do?
Mine is definitely Mona's Valentine's Day statistic, right?
Yeah.
The dollars that we spend on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
And the amount that...
That it could support every mother, pregnant mother and newborn... in the country.
I believe that's a teaser because I don't know if that's a segment that's in this podcast, which means that if you're listening to this podcast, you have to go back and listen
back
to that episode, right?
Listen to the whole episode.
The whole conversation because we get the true meat of it.
Yeah.
Looking forward to next week.
Okay, so that'll do it for Created Equal this week. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org. And of course, make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson. The music is by Sam Bobian. And our executive producer is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.